I'm Dave Bangs, and I've been involved in Downland issues all my life, back to the when my family moved back to Brighton at the end of the 50s. And I've been involved in the politics of the Downs since I came back to Brighton in, I can't remember when, about 1990. So I've been involved in a number of issues around Downland conservation, anti-privatisation campaigns, controversies around land management, both by the council and by private farmers, and of course the issue of public access and the right to roam.
Okay, so what are the various private pressures on the Downs as a public amenity then?
A lot of the, actually, to give you a bit of background, a lot of the eastern South Downs from Arundel eastwards, from the River Arun eastwards, is actually in public ownership. Quite a large proportion by the local authorities, Worthing Council, then to the east, Ada Council. They now work, those two councils now work together. Brighton and Hove City Council, Lewis District, and Eastbourne councils. And two of those councils, Eastbourne and Brighton, have very major land holdings indeed on Downland. In fact, Eastbourne owns all the Downland within its political boundaries. That is, if you're on Downland in the borough of Eastbourne, you are on publicly owned Downland, council-owned Downland. And something very similar to that applies in Brighton. Around half of the Brighton Downs are, a bit under half, are owned by Brighton City Council, and quite a lot of the remainder of the Downs is owned by other public or quasi-public bodies, like two other local authorities and a couple of charities, and also the National Trust and the Sussex Wildlife Trust. So effectively, when you're talking about the Brighton Downs, you're talking about a largely publicly owned landscape. Probably more than two-thirds of the Brighton Downs are in public ownership.
But you call on the Brighton Downs, Dave. We from Kent, etc., South East London, call on the South Downs.
Well, the Brighton Downs are basically the downs between two rivers, between the River Ada, which comes out at Shoreham, enters the sea at Shoreham, and the River Ouse, which comes out at Newhaven, Seaford. I mean, that's what geographically is termed the Brighton Downs, and Brighton Downs actually sits on the chalk outcrop. Most of Brighton's built-up area is actually on the Downs, which is not the case with any other local authority on the whole of the South Downs, really. Most of the urban areas on the South Downs have their built-up components on the coastal plain or adjacent to the Downs or in the Weald, and relatively small proportions of their built-up areas actually on the Downs. But in Brighton, sort of 80% of the conurbation is actually on the sits on the Downs. So, yeah, that's what's called the Brighton Downs, that central portion, that block of Downland between those two rivers.
Well, it sounds good if the local authorities have got ownership of it, that they should be keeping the private interests at bay.
That's you're getting to the heart of the matter. I spent a lot of my childhood, which is basically our childhood, that is from when I was old enough to roam freely without my parents' permission, from about 1960 onwards. I spent the whole of the next 10 years before I left home in 1969 wandering around the Downs and to the north of the Downs in the Weald. And in the whole of that time, I had no idea that I was wandering over countryside which was actually owned publicly. In fact, it was only when I came back to Brighton after being away for 25 years at the beginning of the 90s that I realised what the ownership situation was on the Downs, and I was really astonished. You wouldn't know it was a publicly owned landscape, or you would do now more because progressive changes have been made in the last 30 years since the first Labour council came in Brighton in 87. But for the most part, you would get no sense that this was a publicly owned landscape, because a lot of it is conventionally farmed by private commercial tenant farmers, who, of course, nowadays are all in secure tenancies. Certainly the great majority of the, all but about two of the Brighton farms, there's about 13 major farms on the Brighton Downs estate, and all but two of them are on secure agricultural tenancies under the 1947 Agriculture Act. So they operate effectively like private commercial farm businesses. And you have all the problems that you always do have with private farmers. You know that the bottom line is profit, basically, and then, you know, not just that, but their whole culture and mindset are very small C conservative, and not particularly friendly towards public values. You know, like access and recreation and nature conservation and all the rest of it, you know. Even you could put in that things like soil conservation and conservation of the chalk aquifer, which is where Brighton gets all its water supply from. You know, they operate within commercial norms, and those things are not at the top of their those public values are not at the top of their priorities, really.
So you have had some successes down there, though, haven't you, over the last couple of decades in bringing more attention and actually getting, I suppose, that the walking public mobilised a bit.
We've held our ground and made some modest advances over the period that I've been involved, which is since the beginning of the 90s. One of the first crises that happened when I came back was an attempt by the Labour Council under Steve Bassam, who's now Lord Bassam in the House of Lords. I think he might still be Chief Whip for the Labour in the Lords, I'm not sure. But under Steve Bassam, there was an attempt made to flog off the entire estate. Can you imagine it? A Labour Council wanting to flog off this gigantic conservation asset. Unbelievable. But we fought that one off, and we've since then we've had to do that same thing on a small scale. Since there was another major crisis in 2016 when the council wanted to dispose of parts of the estate to raise capital for a restoration project on a big park. In Brighton, where Sussex University campus is, actually, called Stamber Park. And they wanted to flog off these bits of downland to fund, in inverted commas, a restoration project on Stamber Park, which, as far as I'm concerned, is almost entirely a waste of money. But that's another, and wouldn't form any kind of a priority in my book. But that's another issue, really. That's something else.
Okay, so have you actually managed to get, you know, any kind of status for the Downs to make it, you know, a little, you know, something like either a area of outstanding natural beauty, national park, that sort of thing?
Well, we've been blessed here in Brighton with on the Brighton Downs, that is, not just in Brighton, with having a series of activists of really considerable caliber who fought off and proposed very positive initiatives and fought off very negative ones. I'm thinking, for instance, of a guy called Paul Milmore, who's dead now. He died some years ago, but he was the head of the Countryside Management Service in the County Council, East Sussex County Council. But he did far more than that. He and a man called Phil Belden, who until a couple of years ago was the number two at the National Park Authority, spearheaded a major campaign to get the Sussex Downs into the first tranche of pilot landscapes within the very first agri-environmental scheme, which was introduced in England, which you'll remember was called the ESA scheme, Environmentally Sensitive Area Scheme, and was indeed introduced by the Tories, not by Labour, and this is worth remembering. It was actually a Tory scheme that was introduced under the wretched Selwyn Gummer of Duckhouse fame, if you'll remember. But he introduced that ESA scheme, and Phil Belden and Paul Milmore drove a very hard-working campaign to get the South Downs within the first tranche of target landscapes and won. And those individuals, together with a tranche of other individuals, also powered the revival of the demand for a South Downs National Park. And it was a lot of hard work and a great deal of lobbying and organising, but in the end, we achieved that. So we've done very well in terms of the calibre of some of our activists down here. We've been helped to some extent, by having a green administration as well. But I don't want to over-egg that, because the Greens have had some real successes down here. One of them, for instance, a man called Pete West, who was the very first Green councillor in Brighton, actually drove through the designation of one of the council farms that became big council farm, about 750 acres or something like that. He drove through the designation of most of that farm, 80% for farmers, statutory access land, in the wake of the passing of the Countryside and Rights of Way Act, which brought a partial right to roam, of course, on down pasture. And he drove through that measure of statutory access designation on the Brighton Downs estate. Indeed, he's the only one who's driven through that kind of designation process on downland, which wasn't actually designated within the terms of the Crow Act. The Green Council now are moving towards a position of increasing the rate of designation of land, but I think the question's still open whether they have the political will to drive through the kind of progressive solutions which the Downs need here. But I mean, the issue is not just around, the issues on the Downs generally are not just issues around the local authority estate. There are much broader issues. And of course, there are much broader issues for the Sussex countryside in a wider sense. You know, the issues around public access and nature conservation the halting of the most dreadful wave of development proposals which are hitting the region between the sea and the London Basin. And all these things are in the pot at the same time, really. So the Downs gets a great deal of coverage because it has a very high cultural and political status. But the adjacent landscapes, like, for instance, the most particularly the Sussex Weald, are of just as great landscape and wildlife and public quality as the Downs, but they don't have anything like the same kind of cultural resonance and political clout. So I need to chuck that into the discussion, really, because I sometimes get wearied by the way that the Downs is kind of special cased when actually it's a very, very damaged landscape, and it's still savable, and we'll do our best to do that, but other neighbouring landscapes are of just as great or greater value, and they don't have anything like the political clout that the Downs have. It's worth saying that, you know.
Yeah, you're getting designation for the Downs. It's actually quite important at the moment because we're seeing these, you know, small village-style developments with these almost like Lego brick houses going up at the moment. They're very basically small rooms, hardly any gardens, this sort of thing. They're popping up like there's no tomorrow. And so have you managed, you think, to rein back that, this so-called affordable housing development that seems to be really, I mean, an unprecedented, certainly in my lifetime, I've never seen so many new sites being designated ex-agricultural sites for housing.
Well, there's huge pressures on the way that capitalism, works is that it's always underdeveloping and overdeveloping. There are always regions of hyper exploitation which shrink, which bleed their workforces away to more dynamic in capitalist terms areas, and there are areas which aggregate all the advantages and accrue all the top whack development opportunities and that. And the southeast is very much a favoured area of hyper development with huge inward migration within the United Kingdom and beyond, because that's where the economic activity is. That's the location of preference for elites, you know, middle and owning class elites. And I'm sure this is true for your area too, down in the, you know, in Avon. There are huge centrifugal pressures down in the southeast for capitalist development, and nature and the countryside and food growing, sustainable food growing, come very long way down the list of imperatives in that process. They largely, all those qualities, all those resources, act largely as window dressing, as enticements, as wallpaper for these privileged elites coming into this area to live the good life and exploit the rest of us, you know. I think there are huge development pressures down here. There are development pressures around Brighton on the Brighton Urban Fringe, and part of that is because of the recent betrayals in Labour Party administrations. When we were fighting for the national park, the campaign for the for the national park back at the beginning of the century, in the first 5 years of this century, the Labour Party stymied our attempt to get what I would describe as a cling film boundary for the new national park around the edge of the Brighton built-up area. We argued that because the open downland on the Brighton Downs was so vulnerable, so at risk, and so already so damaged, you needed to have a very bold, inclusive boundary for the national park. All open ground between the edge of the built-up area and the edge of the downland block needed to be in the national park. And the Labour Party resisted that. The Greens and the Tories did their best. But the Labour Party to stop that being the cut to push that through, but the Labour Party resisted that, and so a whole series of high quality urban fringe downland sites were excluded from the national park, and thus are vulnerable to built development, and it makes things very difficult because a lot of the land here is public land. And so you get these crazy conflicts between two goods, the good of social housing and affordable housing, proposals for social stroke affordable, or at least more affordable than market housing, on these sites, and the need for preserving high quality, high nature value, high public recreational value sites on the urban fringe. So they've tried to set these two values against each other, and in a sense we've done quite well in holding that off, particularly at Whitehawk Hill, which is one of the real hotspots for wildlife and history on the Brighton Downs, where we fought off a really awful proposal to break the local nature reserve on the hill in two and put a high-rise development. Absolutely extraordinary bit of craziness to put a high-rise development in the middle of this National Nature Reserve. We fought that proposal off, but that, and we did so by being very straightforward and honest about in our line. We said this is Whitehawk Hill is in a poor area. It's East Brighton. It's a working class area, and so they tried to use housing need as a way to drive that antisocial proposal through, and we were very clear about it. We said crowded working class communities like this should not be forced to choose between their green spaces and their housing. That's not a choice that they should have to make. Those kind of choices should be made by privileged communities of privilege, with privileged levels of access to domestic living space and open space. And there's plenty of them, believe me, in the Brighton conurbation. We did our own mapping exercise, and I did a mapping exercise there, and worked out there's something like about the upper 470 acres within the Brighton built-up area of privileged middle and owning class housing with very luxurious levels of private garden space and very generous levels of adjacent shared public space. And it's in those communities that there should be densification. It's in those communities that, that affordable and social housing should be located, not in the crowded communities of working class people, where those choices should not have to be made, because everyone needs both a decent home and access, and decent access to nature, to green space. Everyone needs those things. So make the communities, make the classes which have got the slack, who've got the privilege to give up some of their slack. Don't make those people whose backs are already against the wall make those kind of choices. We have had some limited success in that regard, but that's just a tiny bit of the big picture, you know. And although the Downs as a whole, I don't think the Downs as a whole now that they're in the national park are, I don't think the development is a major overall. I don't think that development is built development is the major threat. Built development is a huge existential threat to some natural areas, and in Sussex we have two very high value natural areas which don't benefit from statutory landscape scale designations. One is the coastal plain, and the other one is what's called the low weald. And the low weald lies between between the North Downs and the South Downs, but it's a part of the great wooded weald and vale which is not statutory designated. And here you get all the problem with having special, in inverted commas, designated landscapes, because what actually happens is it turns into a balloon squeezing exercise. The pressures, the development pressures in the designated landscapes tend to be deflected onto the undesignated landscapes, irrespective of those undesignated landscapes' intrinsic value. So, for instance, the low weald is actually a very high value landscape. It's extraordinarily rich in historic and prehistoric landscape features, in all sorts of habitats, in waterland habitats of stream and river, chalk streams and river, with its own endemic, genetically distinct variety of sea trout, just in these Sussex rivers, nowhere else. Bigger, later spawning, very, very distinctive. Taxonomically from other varieties of sea trout, existentially threatened with extinction. We've got forest lands, we've got ancient woodlands, we've got ancient meadows and heaths, and that whole patchwork of ancient countryside, of shores and scattered hamlets and woody overgrown hedgerow lanes and copses and hamlets and small woods, all that richness, that palimpsest of landscape is threatened because the low weald does not benefit from statutory landscape scale designation. All the development pressures happen there. So there are huge problems with in this area, even though such a high proportion of it benefits from statutory designation. What you're getting is a replication of what Surrey, the county of Surrey and the North Downs and other surviving parts of the Vale of the River Thames have suffered from, that actually you get the entire landscape turned into a kind of subtopia, and as has happened in semi-urban, in suburban Surrey, you get this appalling mishmash of roads and business parks and housing estates, rich and not so rich, and development and scruffy, semi-derelict and unused land, and all sorts of privileged recreational uses, huge footprints of things like horticulture and golf courses and shooting ranges and more gaming sites and ornamental, private ornamental parks and gardens everywhere. Privilege and destruction, the destruction of the countryside and the destruction of nature. But within all this mess, these extraordinary jewels of high quality habitats surviving. So parts of the North Downs, the Surrey Hills, the Surrey Commons, even parts of the Thameside and the Thameside Meadows, surviving in this is as kind of precious fragments, as kind of turds on the plaza in this mess of subtopian development. And that kind of capitalist trajectory, that kind of very American pattern of land use, is a done job in Surrey. And if we don't have success down in Sussex in another generation or so, it'll be a done job in Sussex too, and in other parts of the nature-rich southeast, like parts of Chiltern.
I know you've been campaigning for quite a while, as you're saying, on the access to the Brighton Downs. Have you found that it's something which is, you know, cross-class? Are you finding support from, you know, the middle classes as well as working-class Brighton people?
Well, it's the other way around. Most of our support, most of our support comes from middle class people. Overt activist support comes from middle class people, and that's always the problem. That the way that capitalism works is that it strips out land based labour. It strips out the organic connection, which is working people. 100, 200, 300 years ago, most of us worked in the countryside in either in agricultural or in related trades and commerce and that. It strips out land-based labour and shoves us, the 99%, the working population, the people who actually make things and create things and manage things, it shoves us out into first villages, then towns, then cities, and now, of course, if you look at the Pacific Rim and the Atlantic Rim and around on a global scale, you see megacities, gigantic megacities with populations as large as the average sized country, cities with populations as large as what until a generation or so ago were average sized countries' populations. This huge process of disconnecting humanity from nature. And what that means, what that huge alienation, that disconnect, which capitalism so far has been very successful in achieving between us, the 99%, and nature, which is our natural matrix, our home, it's where we come from, it's what we depend on. You have the class, which is actually the only class which has the power to abolish capitalism, to rid the world of capitalism and move towards a democratic model of global living. We as a class have that task, that objective task, but we're actually the least equipped to do it because we are the people whose connection with nature has been most thoroughly broken. And so the people who are least alienated from nature are actually middle class and privileged people, culturally privileged people and economically privileged people who have the resources to move into the countryside and colonize it, which they have done in the Sussex Weald and in a huge way, changed the whole demography of that landscape. Those people are relatively unalienated from nature. To be sure, they spend most of their lives trashing nature. That's the nature of their job as capitalists and agents of capitalism. They destroy nature. They're ecocidal. But in their personal lives, you know, having spent their working lives messing the rest of us up and destroying nature, they spend their personal lives enjoying the blessings of proximity to nature and that. So that's the nature of the paradox that we all live in. But I mean, so it tends to be relatively culturally privileged people, middle class people, who join the specialist societies and the environmental campaigns. But I'm not proposing that as any kind of absolute rule. I mean, for instance, the campaign at White Oak Hill was very strongly endorsed to stop the White Oak Hill development was very strongly endorsed by the local working class community. They made it very clear that yes, indeed, they didn't want to make this false choice between their green spaces and their housing. They did indeed want both. So working class people can have their voice, but it's more difficult for working class people. You know, they have a lot more pressures and disadvantages that they've got to climb out from under before they've got the cultural space to do what middle-class people do in terms of radical countryside activity.
Okay, Dave, talking of radical countryside activities, you've had mass trespass this week, actually up on the Downs. Can you tell us, you know, why you thought it was necessary and how things went?
It went brilliantly. I mean, we've got two things coming together here, really. The first one is that on a national scale, there's a new network being set up, which is called Right to Roam. And you'll know of, Tony, you'll know of Nick Hayes and Guy Shrubsole. Guy Shrubsole wrote a book on land ownership, and Nick Hayes has written a book on trespass. They're quite well-known national figures now. They, on a national scale, there's the Right to Roam network, which is attempting to drive forward the public debate on an extension of the Right to Roam. And locally, we have down here around the Brighton conurbation, we have a major exercise in public consultation around the future of the Brighton Downs estate. And I could be very, very, I am very critical of this. Of this exercise, but it does actually flag up, you know, it does actually raise the whole question of who's the Brighton Downs estate for, who needs to benefit from it, what should its future management look like, you know, what are its priorities in terms of nature conservation and sustainable farming practice and all the rest of it. We have two things, a local agenda and a national agenda coming together. Now, the reality of this Brighton Downs estate is that you're having a public consultation about this 13,000-acre estate, but the vast majority of the estate has no right of public access. People are forbidden to go there, and people do not know what they own, collectively own. So the council's asking people to put forward opinions about the future management of that estate in a situation in which most people have no knowledge of the landscape which they are being asked to give opinions on, and it's because of that that we've been engaging in a whole series of activities over the last 2 years to highlight the value of this estate and to inform that, to fill that huge knowledge vacuum which has been created by the reactionary council management over several generations. So we did a film, it was called Brighton's Big Secret, which you can see on YouTube. Brighton's Big Secret, which is a 20-minute film about running through the Brighton Downs estate and showing you and commenting on all the areas which people are very unlikely to know. And one of those areas that the film focuses in on is this place called Pangdean Bottom, which is a really beautiful downland valley, really not far from the Devil's Dyke, which you'll probably know. It's a big hotspot, big downland hotspot, where over the years millions of tourists and walkers have been and a place they've enjoyed. And it's a lovely downland valley, about half a mile long, a third of a mile, a great big huge valley, completely tranquil, beautiful place. And no one has been there. No one knows about it. It's been in public ownership for nearly 100 years. It was bought by Brighton Council way back in 1924. So it's, 97 years it's been in public ownership. And yet no one has been there. Indeed, when we took our trespass there on Saturday, when people had assembled in the Coombe, the first question I asked them was, how many people know about this valley and how many people have visited it? And no one put their hands up to either of those questions. The only people who put their hands up were the small organising group, who of course had been there. So no one outside our tiny little organising group, not one person either knew about the valley or had been there. And indeed, we didn't announce the destination of the trespass until we set off. So there's no way they could have known. Now, this is a complete scandal. This is a really lovely place with very, very beautiful and rich wildlife resources and it very vulnerable. Indeed, the valley has suffered a great deal of damage over the last 50 years or so.
There's a couple of questions I've got to ask you about a mass trespass. One is, how many people turned up? because it's, you know, it's obviously people like walking, but it's not always easy to get persuade people that it's a good idea to go trespassing.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, second question is, what was the weather like?
Well, well, God was definitely on our side. She was very definitely on, not that she exists, but she was very definitely on our side. And we had a beautiful day in terms of weather conditions. And we had a bit over 300 people. A bit over 300 people, half a dozen over 300 or something like that, which was a fantastic result. The biggest mass trespass that we had in the two campaigns of mass trespasses that we organized in 1998-99 to offer support to Michael Meacher in driving through the Countryside and Rights of Way Act that would offer the partial right to roam. The biggest numbers we had there were approaching 250, I think. So we were a bit over 50 or 60 over that title with this mass trespass, and a very large proportion of the folk who turned out were young people. There was quite a lot of oldies as well and middle-aged people and that, but a very large proportion. I wouldn't like to put a percentage on it, but a very large proportion of the people there were young people.
Okay,
we did very well.
Okay, apart from the books you've mentioned, what's the best way that listeners can follow this movement online? Or, you know, there may be other books that you haven't mentioned, particularly about the Brighton Downs.
I'm not saying this just to blow my own trumpet, but the only comprehensive guide that's ever been done to the Brighton Downs is one which I wrote back in 2008, but called The Freedom to Roam Guide to the Brighton Downs, and you can still get that on online secondhand, but it's all in all the local libraries and that. But I mean, the Downs have had their poets and had their writers, but I'd be loath to put one before the other.
What about online? If people want to follow it, where should they go?
They can follow it by going to the Landscapes of Freedom website. That's the name of the local Right to Roam network, which we've set up and which organised the trespass in partnership with, and this is the second place for people to go, the Right to Roam network, and they'll easily be able to Google those two. It would be useful for them too, also to look at the Brighton Downs Alliance website, which is very good. The Brighton Downs Alliance website, and also to Google a small setup called the Friends of the Brighton Downs, it's the Friends of the Brighton Downs, which did the film on the Brighton Downs, Brighton's Big Secret. Just Google something like YouTube, Friends of the Brighton Downs, Brighton's Big Secret, and your film, and you'll get there. And also did a series, as an interactive series of maps on land use on the Brighton Downs. So all those are worth going to. The Brighton Downs Alliance, the Landscapes of Freedom, the Right to Roam Network, and Friends of the Brighton Downs. All those will give you useful information.
Fantastic. Well, Dave Banks, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.